Okay. You understand that the helmsman always takes his orders from the officer on deck, and the officer on deck had been off the bridge for a little while, so we were waiting and giving people a chance to get a quick cuppa. And now we're ready to get underway. So fasten your seatbelts. I realize full well that things are done differently down here at the other end of the world, but I was a little surprised when Adrian sidled up to me down in St. Andrews a couple of days ago and said, the steering committee would like to ask you if you would introduce Lloyd Gearing at the conference. Well, I was a bit surprised, as I say, to introduce the illustrious Lloyd Gearing to a New Zealand audience doesn't seem a job for a Yank. But I figured even if it was a hoax, I'll go along with a joke. We're a jolly bunch, aren't we? Yes, of course. So here we go. And I thought about it. It started to make a little bit of sense. Because you know, as well as I do, that the way we see things alters with where we see them from. You know, we always say, he has a different angle on the thing. Or, from where I stand, it looks as if, or something like that. And so I said, well, you know, maybe the different perspective might provide a different, maybe even an interesting novel image. Speaking of image correction, I immediately thought of the time when I was editing Nigel Leaves's two-volume analysis of Don Cupid's work. Some of you probably have read some of that. Some of you, I'm sure, remember Nigel Leaves. He spoke here several times. And he was a good lad, but he made one mistake in that document that I had to check him up on. I was reading along, and he said he described Lloyd Gearing as New Zealand's Cupid. And having recently read several books by both of those authors, I felt obliged to correct Nigel on this point because time and again I read a paragraph that was parallel to a paragraph in the other's work. A paragraph of Lloyd said pretty much the same as something that Don Cupid had said, and vice versa. I was struck by that, and a lot of marginal note in my editing job there. Well, then I found, looking it up, that Gearing's texts preceded those of Cupid by at least a decade. Well, I can understand that. It's understandable. Nigel, after all, came from Manchester. He was ordained in the UK. And he was sent off to become the vicar of the Anglican, sort of the official Anglican church in Hong Kong, where at one time he read off the governor general and got away with it. I thought that was lovely. And then he was the chaplain to the Bishop of Sydney, where he told me his primary job was looking after the bishop's wife's rose garden. I don't know. And then he became the principal of an Anglican seminary out in Perth. And so, you know, he was looking at things from a slightly different angle, perhaps, and therefore saw Cupid probably as any loyal Brit would no doubt do, especially an Anglican Brit. Therefore, it would tend to rank him above all contenders. And no doubt, from any good Kiwi's perspective, Lloyd Gearing stands high atop either Mount Taranaki or one of the Southern Alps, depending on where you come from and where you take for height. But as far as this Yank is concerned, Lloyd Gearing stands not astride Taranaki or one of the Southern Alps, he stands astride Everest. I have a different view, you see, a different angle. My angle is that Lloyd Gearing belongs not only to New Zealand, but to the world. And that's the fellow I'm introducing to you this evening to start this conference off. Okay? Thank you.
Good, thanks. Good, thank you. It's just one of those accidents of history that when I was involved in a heresy trial 50 years ago, people remarked, well, it's 450 years since Martin Luther. So now we celebrated something about my heresy trial on Friday night at another group 50 years ago, and so it is appropriate to be celebrating the much more important event, the arrival of Martin Luther nailing his reforms on the Wittenberg Church 500 years ago. Now, Martin Luther never set out to reform the church. When he nailed his 95 theses on the door, as tradition has it, he was simply registering a protest. That's why he may rightly be called the father of Protestantism. And in particular, he was protesting against the way in which the church, by selling indulgences, was claiming authority over the eternal destiny of its members. But that was only the climactic point of a period in which this very learned monk had become increasingly critical and even outspoken at the way in which the church proclaimed things which were inconsistent with the Christian gospel, of which he knew a great deal biblically. And by protesting as he did, Luther, no doubt quite unintentionally, did a great deal more than pioneer the reformation of the church. He set in motion three developing trends in Western human culture. And these trends were to have far greater consequences than he ever intended or imagined. And they had to do with, first, the Christian worldview, the way the Christian views reality. Secondly, the role and authority of the church institution. And thirdly, the nature and content of faith. Now I'm going to sketch each one of these in turn from his day until today. First of all, the Christian worldview. In the course of the past 1500 years before Luther, the Christian worldview had changed out of all recognition from what it had been at the beginning. The first Christians, being Jews, simply inherited their culture from the Jewish worldview. It was a three-decker universe. It consisted of the sky, or heaven, the dwelling place of God, as in the Lord's Prayer, our Father who is in heaven. Then below it was the flat earth, the dwelling place of humankind, and below it again was the gloomy underworld inhabited by the shades of the dead, which the Jews called Sheol. Now, the first Christians believed that Jesus, after his crucifixion, had been raised from the underworld of the dead to the overworld of heaven. And the fourth gospel rather quaintly records that way of looking at it, because as he was rising, he accidentally met Mary Magdalene. And he said to her, "Don't touch me, I'm rising." Indeed, we can now say that the myth of the ascension to heaven actually preceded the myth of his resurrection from a burial grave. That was a later legend which grew up to try and explain why, in fact, he was no longer in the underworld, because every grave was part of the underworld. Now, the first Christians believed that Jesus would shortly return from the overworld and establish his kingdom, of which had been the substance of his teaching, the kingdom of God, the rule of God among people. Now, when the expected end did not eventuate, the Christian worldview underwent a radical transformation. Now, this was made possible because in the meantime, in the second century, Christian thinking came under the influence of the great Greek philosopher Plato. Now, Jews had always thought of a human being as an animated body, animated by the breath that was breathed into him as a body of dust at the beginning of time, an animated body. But Plato had taught differently. He taught that the body is simply a physical thing of no great importance, in which dwells an eternal soul. And this way of thinking of the human being became part and parcel of Christian thought from the second century onwards. Plato thought the soul was eternal. There never was a time when it was created, and that there was a time when the soul lived before being, in Plato's view, imprisoned in a body. That notion, by the way, was very beautifully illustrated in Charles Lamb's delightful essay, Dream Children, you may remember. But that part of this of Platonism was not adopted by Christians. They felt that the soul was created and placed in the body. The first Christians inherited from the Jewish Pharisees the notion of a last judgment at the end of time. And that made this a moral universe. It meant you could never get away with anything, because at the end of time, it would all be straightened out, and the good would be rewarded, and the just would have to face up to the effects of their wickedness. But the Christian worldview changed from the Jewish beginning into this, in that it became a three-decker universe in which heaven, the dwelling place, was now accompanied by the souls of the righteous, who at their death had been judged to be righteous. The middle was, of course, the dwelling place of humankind, and the underworld of the dead, Sheol, now became the place of the wicked. And the name of Satan, who in the Old Testament was simply God's public prosecutor, as in the book of Job, now became the ruler of the damned in hell. However, although they made those changes, and they still rather unnecessarily retain the idea of a judgment at the end of time. And at the end of time, our bodies would be resurrected and rejoined with our souls and judged all over again. Now, my Abidonian theological teacher long ago pointed out that was quite superfluous. In Christian doctrine, this remained, however, a double judgment. In all our confessions, you will find it. Now, during the early Middle Ages, this three-decker universe was further changed. A new layer was introduced between the middle deck and the top deck. It was known as purgatory. And it was regarded as a place where the dead were given an opportunity to suffer the consequences of their sins, work out the consequences, as it were, to prepare them for the delightful life in heaven above. Now, once the idea of purgatory had taken root, it brought a great deal of comfort to people. Because, you see, most of them thought they weren't good enough to enter heaven. But hopefully they weren't bad enough to go to hell. So this really was a source of great comfort, purgatory. And there it might have stayed if it hadn't been for the fact that the Pope hit upon an idea. And that was, he could use this idea. After all, he, according to the New Testament, had the power of the keys that had been given supposedly to Peter. You remember what the New Testament said? And so the Pope hit upon the idea of using this concept of purgatory to raise money, to build the new Church of St. Peter's that now stands in Rome. He offered the opportunity to lessen the time that people spent in purgatory. He offered people the opportunity to help their deceased friends and relatives in purgatory by selling them indulgences. It was a wonderful idea of raising money, wasn't it? Well, it became the straw that broke the camel's back. And that's where the monk Martin Luther comes in 1517, to make his historic protest. And he had complete confidence in his protest because his study of the Bible showed him quite clearly there was absolutely no biblical warrant for the idea of a purgatory at all, as there was, of course, for heaven and hell. So Luther's protest led to the sudden disappearance of purgatory. We probably don't realize what a tremendous shock that was at the time, because most people expected to go there, and it wasn't there anymore. And it meant that from now, when you died, you're either up there or down there. It was something that Protestant preachers made a great deal of over the next 200 or 300 years. People were afraid to die as they had not been before, particularly if they were not in communion with the church or had failed to have their sins absolved. And that's why regular absolution had been a practice every Saturday night. Now, what Luther did not and could not foresee was that such a catastrophic change in the Christian worldview as to remove purgatory was to have subsequent changes to the worldview. After the 18th century Enlightenment, when people were encouraged now to think for themselves, that's what free thinkers means, free to think for themselves, attention began to fasten on other aspects of this unseen spiritual world. Of course, it only exists, you see, in our imagination. And so, during the 19th century, theologians began to question the concept of hell. They felt it could not be morally justified or synthesized with the idea of God's eternal love. Eternal life and eternal hell? How can that be allowed by such a heavenly Father? And so, once it was questioned, it gradually began to fade out of the picture. And I can remember it was still very much in the picture when I was young, but gradually from there, during the 20th century, it was less and less in the mind view of Christians, except for perhaps a few rigid fundamentalists. Now, that left the concept of heaven still operating well into the 20th century, and for some people still. John Bailey, a great Scottish theologian of Edinburgh, in 1934, wrote a book called And the Life Everlasting. Now, I heard John Bailey lecture because in the celebration in 1948 of the centenary of Otago and Southland, he was brought out as part of the celebrations there. And I read his book round about that time. And when I did it, I was rather surprised to find what was there. He defended the traditional idea of a post-mortem existence for the Christian in heaven, but he based it on philosophical grounds, such as Platonism, and not upon the biblical sources still being appealed to by the fundamentalists. It's not surprising that from that time onwards, the Christian idea of heaven has been slowly disappearing from our imaginations as a vague afterlife. It's appealed to perhaps by spiritualists and in a vague kind of non-religious way, and that's been happening during the 20th century. Indeed, we can document it by the way in which the funeral service has changed so significantly during the 20th century. When I was a young minister, it was a ceremonial send-off to the next world. I, to my shame, conducted many funeral services which took no more than 15 minutes because it was quite easy to send it off in the sure and resurrection of the world to come. We never had eulogies when I was young at funeral services. What's happened in the 20th century that more and more eulogies have taken over? And what is now a funeral service is a time to give thanks and praise for what the deceased person has been to them during life. There's often a good deal of amusement now at funeral services, you may have noticed, with practically no reference at all to their departure to another world. Now, Luther, of course, was a man of his time. He couldn't be expected to foresee that the abolition of purgatory was eventually going to lead to the abolition of hell, and finally to the abolition of heaven. That's the first great consequence of Martin Luther. Now we'll turn to the second movement he initiated, one that concerned the role and authority of the church. Now, the essence of this is to be found in the Protestant slogan, the priesthood of all believers. It's not a phrase that Martin Luther actually used, but it's implied in his thinking, and in particular, he was very fond of a verse in 1 Peter, which said, you, meaning you believers, are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Now, Luther wanted to reassert the equal status of all Christian believers. He wanted to abandon the grades into which they had come to be divided. And in particular, he set out to remove two types of divisions. First, the division between the religious and the seculars. I'll explain that presently. And secondly, he wanted to destroy the division between the priesthood and the laity. Now let's look at the first. Between the religious. The religious was the name used to refer to monks and nuns who had chosen to give their lives completely in a community. And the seculars were the priests and the laity who lived in the world. Now, Christian monasticism had, of course, a long history. It started among the desert fathers in Egypt in the 3rd century. And there, Saint Pachomius gathered these religious hermits together in a community and formed the first monastery. Then in the 6th century, Saint Benedict established the rules by which monasteries and nunneries lived thereafter over the next 1,000 years. And by the time of Luther, monasticism had developed into such a widespread phenomenon in the evolution of Christendom that there were nearly 10% of all citizens living in monasteries or convents. They were dotted all around Europe. And there they prepared themselves for the life to come. Now, Christians became divided then into two classes. The religious, the monks and the nuns, and the seculars, the priests and the laity, who chose to remain in the world. Parish priests in the Middle Ages were known as the seculars. The religious were commonly regarded as Christians first class because they were wholly committed to serve their Lord, while the secular Christians they regarded as Christians second class. Now, Luther completely rejected this division of Christians into two classes. And as the Reformation spread, his judgment led to the dissolution of all religious monasteries and convents. In England, it was quite catastrophic because Henry VIII used it to his advantage. He'd already broken with the Pope, so he closed down 900 religious houses in about 15 years. And then he pocketed their assets, confiscated their lands. By the end of the 16th century, there was hardly a convent or monastery to be found in Europe. Now, viewed in this larger context, this move may be seen as an important step to the democratizing of all society. Now, we're so used to the idea of democracy today that we forget that in the ancient world, and right up to the 16th and 17th centuries, the stratification of society into unbridgeable classes was something simply taken for granted. You never rose from the bottom to the top. A relic of that is actually to be found still in the British Parliament, in Westminster Parliament, which consists of the House of Lords and the House of the Commons. And the House of the Lords consists of the bishops of the Church of England and the lords of the Church of England, or that is, the aristocratic class of society. And it's still there. And they have the right to scrutinize and supposedly even veto the decisions of the House of Commons. So these things take a long time to change. Luther also rejected the idea of an authoritative priesthood, one that claimed to be able to exercise authority over a person's eternal destiny. And that led the Lutheran and Calvinist churches to abolish the priesthood. They abolished the priesthood as a Christian order. They replaced it with the ordained ministry of word and sacraments, with the emphasis on service rather than on authority. They acknowledged that there needed to be an order of men, and they were men and not women in those days, an order of men who were especially commissioned to preserve order in the community of Christian believers. But whereas the priest used to stand between God and the Christian believer, the minister did not. The minister had a pastoral role to nourish the faith and advise the believer, but never stood between the believer and God. And because of his special training, he became the official interpreter of the Bible, which in Protestantism replaced the Pope as the authority. Now, the reformers were guided by the pattern of the early church, which had overseers, in Greek episkopoi, elders, presbyters in Greek, servers, deacons in Greek. And that was taken for granted, that concerning those ordained to the ministry, they should follow what the early church did. Now, the Anglican church never went so far as the other churches that emerged out of the Protestant Reformation. They retained more of their former Catholic status and were proud of it. They simply broke their allegiance with the Pope. But they also followed the lead of the early church by regarding the episcopoi and the presbyters as priests. They argued that presbyter is simply priest, writ large, was one of their favourite ways of describing it. Now, the chief ruling body of the church in Presbyterianism is presbytery, which merely simply means the elders. And they avoided any return to priestly authority, first of all, by always insisting in the Presbyterian Church that a presbytery is made up of equal number of ordained ministers and lay elders, to avoid any domination by the ordained. Generally speaking, we may regard the changes in the church organisation that began at the Reformation to be the first steps in the democratization of the church. Now, these steps were all of a piece with the growth of democracy in society at large. The authority of the papacy had unified Europe. It was a Christendom. The Protestant rebellion against the papacy did not lead to one form of Protestant church. It led rather to a collection of national Protestant churches. And in turn, this division became the forerunner of further fragmentation. So that by the 19th century, there was a whole host of denominations and sects, and in fact, still are. Late in the 19th century, some of these began to unite, and it led to the 20th century movement of ecumenical movement, which alas eventually collapsed. Now, a second slogan of the Reformation was justification by faith. By this, Luther meant that it is by faith alone that the sinner is restored to a right relationship with God. Not by doing good works, good deeds. And so strongly did Luther affirm this that he took a strong dislike to the Epistle of James in the Bible. He dismissed it an epistle of straw, he said. He said he would laugh at it if it wasn't for the fact that it was in the Bible. Now, the Epistle of James, in contrast to Luther, insisted, and I believe rightly so, that faith without works is dead and meaningless. Luther's insistence on justification by faith had the long-term effect not only of undercutting the power of the priesthood, but also the need for the structure of the church itself. As I've already indicated, this didn't happen all at once. It's been a slow process since that time. The disintegration of the one holy Catholic Church into an increasing number of denominations and sects was only steps in a long process by which, by the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century, we are observing the gradual disappearance of church organizations at all, leaving behind communities which don't see themselves as the church, of which, say, the Ephesus group, the Sea of Faith group, all sorts of groups who meet together with a certain desire to nourish spirituality, but they are not controlled by any authority. Now, the movement we know as the Reformation applied only to the structure of the church that I've been describing. It didn't affect the basic elements of the Christian faith. Protestants and Catholics were united in what they believed about the faith, in the creeds. They both accepted the historic creeds. But the Protestants went a little further now, and they added their own denominational confessions. Presbyterians will remember very clearly the Westminster Confession, which became so dominant until the beginning of this century. And that was because they no longer had a pope to appeal to decide issues, so it was the confessions which decided the smaller issues. It wasn't until the 18th century Enlightenment that faith itself came to be questioned. The pioneers of the Enlightenment took the Reformation theme, priesthood of all believers, to its logical conclusion. They were known as free thinkers because they claimed the right to think through things for themselves. While only a few, at first, went to the extreme of questioning the existence of God, they pioneered the critical thinking which has become so widespread and which today we all enjoy. Indeed, the Christian world has broken out of the rigid framework of thought which held it together until the last 100 or 2 years. This critical thinking led to the flourishing of biblical scholarship in the 20th century. It has led to the end of Christendom. It led eventually to the death of God, theologians. Now I turn to the third movement he started. And that stems from Luther's historic stance, the nature and content of faith. As our biblical scholars have recently demonstrated, it was at the very beginning of Christianity, and largely under the impetus of Paul, that the historical figure of Jesus of Nazareth was transformed and indeed replaced by the divine figure of Christ, so that through most of Christian history, the original Jesus has been largely forgotten. In a similar way, faith became transformed. It became transformed into the acceptance of a set of beliefs, as the very word creed tends to illustrate. And to this very day, it is assumed that to be a Christian, you must hold certain orthodox beliefs. But that is not what Jesus was on about. When he said to the paralytic, "Your faith has made you whole," he didn't first of all question the man about his beliefs and judge whether they were orthodox or not. What Jesus was referring to was the paralytic's attitude of trust. For that is what faith basically means. Faith has less to do with the mind and more to do with the heart and soul of oneself. Or, if you like, the whole person, body, mind and soul. It is that which responds in trust. That is, has faith. Faith is an internal attitude directed towards objects and subjects of one's environment. For example, faith involves trusting one's friends, trusting the future, even trusting oneself. And Teilhard de Chardin once said, "If I, for some unknowable reason, were to lose my faith in God and in Christ, I would still have faith in the world." And by that he meant he was so overawed by the process of evolution in the world and the evolution of life and what is flowering in life, he would continue to trust himself to it. Now, it may be claimed that it was Luther's basic, "Here I stand, I can do no other," was the beginning of the rediscovery of the nature of personal faith, personal trust. It was this faith which gave him the courage to question some of the basic practices of the church, the faith, the courage to defy the authority of the Bible, even at the risk of his own life. So when we separate faith from the holding of certain beliefs, we are set free, free to explore, free to become ourselves, free to create what we may become. Faith does not enslave us. It's beliefs that enslave us. Now, we can have little faith or great faith. The great achievers in the world have been the people who have had great faith. Yet even that needs to be examined, because faith has to be accompanied by values. Values that are going to achieve certain results. It can be said that Hitler and Gandhi were both men of great faith, but they had very different values. And that because the values we hold shape whatever our faith leads us to achieve. And we do not so much choose our values as we find our values choosing us. And that is why the role of the concept of God has played such an important place in history. First in polytheism, the belief in many gods, And then in monotheism, the belief there's only God one, because God can be understood as a bundle of our highest values, truth and compassion and goodness and justice. And we do not create these values. We find these values calling us to respond to them. The Western world has changed out of all recognition during the 500 years since Martin Luther. So much so, and perhaps more than any other individual, Martin Luther helped to bring the modern world into being in the ways I've tried briefly to describe. But he had no idea he was doing so. His stance actually led to the fragmentation and end of Christendom. And he probably would have been shocked to think that was the case, because it led first to national churches, followed by an increasingly multiplication of denominational churches and sects. But his stance also opened up to the way to the Enlightenment, where people can feel free to think for themselves and, in the end, free to make themselves as they respond to their highest values. Today we glory in living in a post-Enlightenment period. It's only to be expected that that would mark the end of the authoritative church, which in turn would lead to the increasing decline of church organizations. The enthusiastic gatherings of charismatic Christians is no replacement for the organized church of the past. This current phenomenon is not the renewal of the church, as some regard it. Indeed, I regard it as the swan song of the organized church, because these gatherings appeal to emotions and not to reason, so that feeling takes over and dominates. Indeed, they're going back to the origins of religion, because if you go back to the, in biblical study, the great prophets of the Old Testament developed out of a phenomenon in which people used to work themselves up into a frenzy and expect the divine to speak to them. And that was replaced eventually by prophets who used their minds as well. And that is why using one's mind is so important in all religious experience. Now, Luther would have had no time for the charismatics. He was driven by ideas and values which underlay the strength and power of Christendom, and these have continued to shape modern culture. Today's humanistic, secular culture is the direct product of past Christian culture. Indeed, they are also the most vibrant components of the global culture which is now emerging. It is 2,000 years since the first Christians declared, it was their basic doctrine, the doctrine of the Incarnation, God has come down to earth to dwell among humans and to establish his rule or kingdom. What could be more orthodox than that? But when we retranslate that from the supernatural setting in which it was said into today's secular setting, this is what it means. It means the bundle of our highest values, symbolized and personified in the mythical word God are now manifesting themselves in increasing way in human minds and in our culture, and are doing it on a global scale. Turn your mind back to 1900 and think of what has happened in the 20th century. The acknowledgement of human rights, the abolition of the death penalty, the greater equality between the sexes, the liberation of the gays and lesbians, the more intensive care of the disadvantaged, and hopefully the end to international war due to the establishment of the United Nations Organization, inspired by a vision of a community of nations living in peace and harmony. We must not cease to value what has been happening for the good. And in this long and complex process of the coming to earth of the kingdom of God, Martin Luther, in the ways I've tried briefly to describe, played a leading role. We honour his memory in his 500th anniversary of his heroic act. Thank you.
Don't run off quite yet. Don't run off quite yet. Now you see why I suggested earlier that comparisons are always invidious. Lloyd is not somebody else's something. Lloyd is Lloyd, and he is incomparable. That's why we keep coming back here and listening to him, because he teaches us things we didn't know, he reminds us of things we've forgotten, and he sets us a challenge of how we might make our lives a little bit better. He's great. Thank you.